Welcome to The Lowdown, KMXT's new daily show dedicated to giving you the up-to-date information we have available on the COVID-19 outbreak and how it's impacting life on Kodiak Island. The Lowdown will focus on the facts as provided to us by local and state officials. During the show, we give you access to local officials and experts on COVID-19 and community actions related to it. If you have questions for our guests, please email them to lowdown@kmxt.org or call KMXT at 486-3181. You can find a list of upcoming guests on our Facebook page or on our website, kmxt.org. Audio from each day's program will be posted on the website.
Thank you for tuning into the Wednesday morning. Thanks for tuning into our Wednesday Doc the Rock version of the Lowdown. We've been at this seemingly for months now, and thankfully I don't think that there's a pandemic fatigue in the room as of yet. I seem to have more questions for these folks every week, and I know you do as well. Some of the old questions keep popping up from the community, but we seem to get new ones every week. We have these shows online, so I would suggest if you have questions, you don't hear an answer today, take some time and go onto the website and then listen to some past shows. It's some always engaging discussions. If you have a question now, though, and you'd like to add it to the conversation, shoot us an email or give us a call, and we'll try and get it answered by the end of the show. In the studio today, again, we have Dr. Steve Smith from Providence, Dr. Evan Jones from Canada, and Elsa DeHart from Public Health. Good morning, all.
Good morning.
Things change, you know. From last Wednesday when we were in the room, I saw a lot of notes passing back and forth during the course of the show, and it raised my antennas a little bit. And of course, then after the show, we got confirmation that there was another case on the island, and then we've got another one subsequent. So we have a lot of questions from the community about what's going on, what kind of transmission do we have. What are the circumstances of the people who have been testing positive?
So all of our people now, I mean, our first three have all recovered and are out of isolation and doing just fine. But we do have two new cases in town, and both of these cases were community transmission. So we know that they weren't, they're both residents, they both live here, and picked up the virus somewhere in our community, and we don't know exactly where.
So that's when the contact tracing goes into effect. As soon as you get the positive case, you start doing your contact tracing, and you haven't been able to identify the source. So somewhere in the community.
So contact tracing is twofold. The first part we always worry about is getting a hold of everybody who may have been infected by this person, so that we can isolate them and hopefully isolate that case and not have more spread. And then the other piece is we do like a source investigation and go back to try and see if we can see where this person may have contracted the infection, so we can.
So this is where the multiple thing comes into place, where you've had, you know, if you can list the people that you've been in the room with, you know. So do we have a situation now where people saw too many people for you to be able to trace it all down? Is that what you're saying?
Well, no. That piece of it is for the infectious piece, you know. So that is the, like, 2 days before somebody is symptomatic or tests, either or. We go back, and that's considered their infectious period. So those are the people we need to know so we can isolate them, right? So those are the ones that when Curtis says you need to know everybody, we need to know those people that are at risk. And then, yes, it is nice if people know where they were and what they were doing 2 weeks ahead of that. Because then we go all the way back 2 weeks and ask everybody, what were you doing? Where did you go? You know, that kind of thing. It's really hard for people to remember. I mean, can you even remember what you ate a week ago or did a week ago? You know, it's pretty hard sometimes to remember, especially if you're out in the community and not hunkered down anymore, where you were or what you were doing.
Well, you know, I could if I had a logbook. When, you know, if you're logging in your food, and I know it's been suggested you start logging in your contacts too, but not everybody does that meticulously.
You have your phone. You could stick it in your notes. You know, today I did this or that, or put it on your calendar. You know, that would be That'd be fabulous for us.
Yeah, but chances are if you're going into a communal situation and you're there with people that you don't know, then you're not going to be able to log in who you were with.
Right. You can say, I went to Safeway and I went to Walmart, you know, I went to Subway, whatever, you know. And so that's when it gets kind of tricky. It's kind of hard to identify unless we have a bunch of people that were in the same place in one day. That's why we look at all of them together. So maybe we can see that, you know, on the mainland, there were a bunch of people who all went to church on a certain Sunday. And all of a sudden we start seeing cases all pop out from that church. So we kind of know that's where that source was.
So this is when the modeling kicks in, when there's community transmission for it spreading through a community fairly quickly, right?
Yes, it certainly can, yeah.
So what does the ordinary person do in a situation where there is community transmission?
Well, you do all the things we're supposed to be doing. You know, you're washing your hands, you're doing staying away from people 6 feet as much as possible, wearing your masks and hoping everybody else is too. Those are our important take-home. Mm-hmm. Haven't changed.
I still hear people saying, well, the masks really don't block viruses, and I'm going to address that yet again. This is like our local Kodiak Police Department. They wear a bulletproof vest. And guess what? It doesn't block every bullet that could possibly come their way. And it's uncomfortable, and it's hot. But guess what they put on every day? Because they have a higher chance to be exposed to bullets. They put on a bulletproof vest. And is it 100% chance that they're not going to be harmed if somebody shoots at them? No, but man, if somebody's going to shoot at me, I'd love to have a bulletproof vest on. And masks aren't perfect, but they are bulletproof vests for you when it comes to COVID-19, that this is a way of blocking most of the virus that's going to be expelled from somebody around you. So I still encourage people, wear masks when you're going to the store and wash your hands. These are the main modes of transportation. When we look down to the viral level, that even the N95 masks probably don't block all of that, but we don't worry about that. Most of this has been transmitted in droplets. And we haven't declared this a droplet disease yet, but most of it gets transmitted through droplets. So you're going to be blocking out 90-95%. And if two people are wearing masks, it's going to be very, very small chance that you're going to transmit the disease.
As part of the contact tracing, do you do like an interview with the person that tests positive to find out what their normal protocol, you know, how careful they have been?
Yeah. I mean, so what happens is that we hear there's a case, you know, the provider share, you know, we find out either through Epi or they call us here in Kodiak. We have such a great community and everybody's trying to really work together. So it's really nice. We hear there's a case and, you know, we make sure that the providers have time to talk to the person first, you know, and kind of tell them that they're positive, if we can. And here that's not usually a problem. Then we get the information and we call up the infected person. And so, yes, it's a fairly extensive interview, you know, everywhere they've been, what they've been doing, all their information, you know, who their household contacts are, you know, if they have any chronic health issues, the whole thing. It's a huge, you know, interview with them. And a part of that then is really carefully going through everywhere they had been first those first 2 days. And we get that group of our people that were worried might also have been infected by them. And then to go back those 14 days and try and find out where they may have picked up the virus. So it's a fairly extensive interview. And then we contact each one of those close contacts and talk to them. And so the close contacts are also expected to quarantine for 14 days, the people that are close, as well as the person who's infected usually comes out of isolation a little sooner because they've already been sick. You know, the other people were waiting to see if they're going to get sick.
Yeah.
So.
And just to be clear, on this case, the person was completely asymptomatic. And so we talk about, you know, I don't feel sick. I don't feel like I need to get tested. In this case, it was an employment requirement. And that person got tested and turned positive. No symptoms at all. And so it's a fortunate case that we caught it when we did.
Mm-hmm.
But there may be many other people walking around town with no symptoms. And it's difficult to assess how many people they could spread it to.
it makes it very difficult for you to try and conduct your life if you want to do it safely, if you, you know, if it's such an invisible thing.
Yeah, I hate them too, but we keep saying, because, and I'm not always great about wearing my mask everywhere, but I have made a renewed mental effort that I'm going to wear my mask. Because I have a higher chance of giving it to other people. I'm exposed to more sick people mm-hmm. than the average person. I have a lot of contacts because of my job. And just to keep the people around me safe, I feel like, all right, I need to do a renewed effort everywhere I go in public that I'm going to wear my mask.
I think a lot of people, it's an alarm bell when one goes off. It, you know, when we get the notice that there's going to be another release from the ESC, it sets off alarm bells and people start changing their behavior. Kind of, you become a little bit more ultra conservative. And can you, even if you are ultra conservative, still sort of keep this away from you if you're concerned about getting it?
Yeah, you stay mm-hmm. home.
You stay home.
You used to hunker down, except for, you know, that trip to Safeway with your mask on at 6 in the morning when nobody else is there, or very few people, you know.
But yeah. I'll continue to emphasize the things that we love mm-hmm. to do, go outdoors. It's
true.
Just a matter of social distancing. It's a matter of, as we were saying earlier, physical distancing that you can still go to so many places in Kodiak. It's not like you have to be inside your house. It's just that you're just going to stay away from people a little bit till this passes. And people ask me, when is this all going to be over? I have no idea. I'm just as sick of it as anyone else, I think. Mm-hmm. But I don't know the answer to that.
So how does it work now with us? Isn't this the kind of something that we anticipated happening with opening up the state?
I think so. You now have more people who are out, told that you don't have to stay inside or hunker down and you can go out in public. We're encouraged to wear a mask, do the physical distancing. But when more and more people are allowed to have more leeway, not everybody's going to practice that. So I think it's pretty much expected. And we're seeing more travel, too.
Right.
Well, I think with that, even when they opened up, it wasn't like, oh, now it's safe to open up. It was like, now we have more PPE in the state and we have more mm-hmm. hospital beds available and our ICU capacity is built up. So now we are better prepared for it.
Yeah. You're prepared, but you've been prepared for 3 months now, waiting for something to happen. Are you that prepared to where if this really blooms in the community, we have the capacity to be able to meet the demand?
So the big thing to me is 3 months ago, currently we are testing about 60 people a day. 3 months ago, we had the capacity to test 60 people total for the month. Mm-hmm. And so now our testing has gone up significantly. The person who turned positive, we would have never caught before because we weren't doing that widespread testing. That person would have had to have symptoms. They would have had to have a checklist of things wrong with them before we'd even consider testing them. And so that person would have gone in the community continuing to potentially spread it.
Also, I have a question about the numbers again. There's always a lot of curiosity about where they get reported as, what kind of cases there are. You know, I'm looking at the CDC site today, says in Kodiak Island Borough, there's 2 cases with 1 recovered.
Okay, so I don't think they've considered, it takes a while for the process to show our people are recovered, you know, for Epi to finish their paperwork. So basically our initial cases have recovered. So that's a good thing. According to public health, you know, I mean, there's a little bit, sometimes there's some people may even have some lingering symptoms for a while that medical may not say, but according to public health and like what they say, they've been recovered. The other thing is non-residents are not reported. They're reported in a different section. So 2 of our cases are non-reported as well. So 1 just happened yesterday, so it's likely not on the report yet,
okay.
You know. The 2, you know, then we had, so those are, we had 2 residents, and then we had 2 that were non-residents. So those are reported. when you read the statistics, there's always a caveat, you know, this many non-resident people. So they get grouped into that piece.
It seems sort of ridiculous.
Well, it's because it's the way it works for epidemiology. They kind of belong to there. We had two of our deaths that happened in Seattle and were never even here, but they got attributed to Alaska because they were Alaskan residents. So they get attributed to where they are. It's for epidemiology, okay. Yeah. So you have to kind of look at those non-resident numbers as well.
We're talking in general terms, though. We know we've had five cases
yes,
in town.
We have had five cases in town.
And this nobody is in the hospital yet.
Knock on wood.
No. Yeah.
And when you're asymptomatic, when you come in and you test asymptomatic and then you're quarantined, that's the period then thereafter where you're going to begin to develop worse symptoms? I mean,
you could. Sometimes they're saying asymptomatic or actually pre-symptomatic.
Right.
So we don't, you know, sometimes.
So it's usually this, that's kind of the danger point, isn't it, for shedding virus into the community when you're in this asymptomatic period? Or is it when you actually are, you know, you're showing symptoms and you're out in the community? Or does it not make a difference?
So there, once again, there's so many new, this is such a new disease. We don't know the answer for sure. There was a point there where we thought young people who were often more asymptomatic than older people were super spreaders. They are the ones really spreading around the community. That seems to be possibly not bearing out to be true. I'm absolutely certain that you can spread it and be asymptomatic. Mm-hmm. But probably you are more likely to spread it if you do have symptoms. But honestly, the things I was saying here on this show 2 months ago are absolutely untrue, because we're still discovering things as we move along. When this disease process started, it originally, we've discussed this off the radio, but originally they're saying 5% death rate, then down to 2.5% and 1%. Now we're probably at a 0.26% death rate. Which is still, it seems low, but that is not low. I mean, if everyone in Kodiak got this disease, that means we'd have about 30 deaths on this island. But we're still discovering so much about how this disease spreads and who it spreads from. And so I don't think we have absolute truth with these answers yet, but we're discovering them more and more.
So, Mike, one of the things I'd say is we're really worried about the asymptomatic carrier spreading it. If somebody's symptomatic, everybody has heightened awareness, and we're taking precautions on that patient that once they're symptomatic and they come to the medical field's attention, everybody's all over it. You're keeping them, if they would come to the hospital or in a negative pressure room, we're really isolating those individuals from the rest, but it's before they come to our attention that's the people we worry about, spreading it out in the community and then infecting somebody who becomes symptomatic, and then they come to the attention of the medical profession in a much different way.
So for the ordinary citizen, you have to kind of look at everybody and say, you're asymptomatic potentially, and that's why the physical distancing is that important for mm-hmm. you.
Yep. Yeah.
So it makes it that much more important for you now to keep your bubbles as small as you can, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. You just don't know who among us is infected and who could give it to you. And frankly, I can't tell you how easy it is to get from an asymptomatic patient.
Yeah. Right. So that leaves our business community kind of in an odd place, right?
It is a tough one. It's a tough one, but once we keep going back to it, but just protect yourself. Going back to my police analogy, just because they know people can shoot at them doesn't mean they never leave the police station, but they're careful. They're thoughtful about what they do. They do protect themselves to a certain extent. There is danger with it, but doing the best you can with it is important. If it's not absolutely, I still think that We have some tough decisions to make if we continue to have some cases here. Do we consider hunkering down for a 1 week period? I don't know what the decisions are going to be made on that. But it is a tough decision because it is pretty devastating to the local businesses when that occurs. And I do sympathize with that. And a lot of people, if we're hunkered down, they're not working. And that's a pretty tough thing to tell people to do. If you've got one income and you're not working, that $1,200 check from the government does not go far in Kodiak.
So I would say, too, that, you know, most of the businesses in town created fabulous mitigation plans that they provided to the EOC. And, you know, I think we've just gotten a little lax. I would really encourage people to kind of follow those plans because they really have some good, really great plans out there.
I'd like to commend the businesses, too, because I think they've been more thoughtful, more careful than most of the average Joes around, including the canneries, including the Coast Guard, including all of the small businesses, really being thoughtful about not wanting to spread it. So I have to commend the local businesses. I think they've done an excellent job, personally.
I have a question about a rumor, so let's throw it out there and see if you know anything about it. There a rumor of a case in Alitac?
I don't know anything about it.
Yeah, I don't know anything about it.
We've had a case in a remote area of the community.
Community.
Of the island in a remote area.
So how does contact tracing work for the villages?
Well, it's the same way. We have phone numbers or we have email or we have satellite phones or we have whatever we need to get a hold of somebody. So it's the same.
No, if you had a report of a case in the village or, mm-hmm. or there was a case in the village, would we fly somebody out local or are there people on the ground out there that are capable of doing it for you?
Well, public health, like if we had a case in the village in Kodiak, because this is our region, public health would still make the phone calls and do the calls. And we would work really closely, hopefully with the village clinic, who's ever out there to, you know, help us identify people or sources or whatever's happening. So
after working in the villages, you know that the community health aide is going to know far more than if you tried to go out there yourself and do it yourself. They know everybody's friends. They know everybody they've been in contact with. The community health aides do an excellent job kind of keeping what's going on in the villages. And so when I have questions, I call the community health aide and they can tell me the answer.
Villages are a beautiful thing, aren't they? Everybody knows all their business.
Yes.
There's some drawbacks to that. Mm-hmm. A couple of questions about, you know, the community response in regards to shutting us down again, you know. Do the numbers have to get to a certain level before, you know, the decision is made that we need to start pulling back on things even more officially? You know, are we going to go into a community quarantine again? I know that's a really tough question. I mean, that's probably something that you know, you're going to have to sit down and think through, but has that discussion already taken place?
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Yeah, the Emergency Service Council has, you know, 2 weeks ago asked what would happen, what would we as medical providers go, what would really worry you? And I think even said it well, two cases that were simultaneous that were not related in the community and not travel related, that would start to really cause concern that we might have to look about some hunkering down. But I think the Emergency Service Council is all over that. They're asking questions and reevaluating it. So they're doing a good job, and they're looking forward to hopefully it doesn't happen, but they're at least looking forward to that contingency.
Well, it does seem like that there's been a kind of a significant spike throughout the state. The cases seem to be popping up everywhere. And to get two in a week seems pretty concerning, you know?
Yeah, so even though these are considered community spread, I think it's, timing-wise, it's to me, it's pretty obvious. It came in with this influx of people coming in for summer work. It's hard to say where they came from, but I feel like it is just the seasonal travel that's mm-hmm. part of Kodiak. And I think all of us had a little bit of pause when they loosened things up at the same time we're having the influx of summer travel. It's as physicians, when I'm changing a drug, I like to change one drug at a time so I know what's doing what. And when you start changing multiple variables, it really makes it more complex. I like simple.
We do not have simple, though. There's a question about the age range of the people in the community. Are you free to talk about that?
Oh, our age range has all been young adults. I mean, you know, that are our cases. I mean, okay. We can safely say that. They do that on the thing, divide them into, you know, I mean, for the whole state. But I think most of ours have been
I think young adults. Some of the reflection of that is those of us who fall into that older category, certain companies accepted, we're probably a little more careful because we know that mm-hmm. you're more at risk. So if you're in that high-risk category, I think people are taking a lot more cautionary moves to try and not become infected. They're either having somebody else go do their grocery shopping or they're taking advantage of slotted times to do that shopping. And they're staying away from people. I mean, I'm seeing older adults who would be in that symptomatic or not symptomatic, but in that more high risk category, they're not getting together for dinners. They're not going to church. They're keeping their physical distancing. So I think that's why we're not seeing it spread across the whole age range at this time.
Well, it may be a way to decrease or, you know, to avoid the death rate. I mean, if we're still looking at this of, you know, principally this is hitting the people in the underlying conditions range, right? Those mm-hmm. are the people that are more at risk. And if they can avoid getting it, you may have some younger people that have need for hospitalization or special services, right? But we're not pushing the death rate. You know what I mean?
So, I mean, right now we've had all young people, yeah. and they really haven't been drastically affected. We haven't had to bring anybody into the hospital. And so it, for some people, it's just a cold is mm-hmm. what it comes down to. But some young people are pretty drastically affected, and it's really hard to predict. It's really hard to figure out what the difference is between, you know, we've had 34-year-old physicians who were in great health who died. Mm-hmm. We've had people in their mid-20s who were near death and recovered but still have compromised lungs to the point where some people are in line for lung transplants. And so there's been some pretty drastic effects of this disease on some people. And I can tell you a lot of things that are associated with what that they wonder if it's a possibility, but I don't think we understand it yet. For some reason, this disease does hit African Americans very hard, hits the Hispanic community very hard. You know, and from this, we're trying to extrapolate what's the difference. I mean, there's a higher level of diabetes and hypertension among some of these communities, but is that really it? Is that the only cause? Is it poor access to medical care? Is it some other factor that's going on? People ask me what can I do, and the only thing I can tell them right now, and this is truly a shooting from the hip, I don't know answer, but I say if you live in Kodiak, Alaska, you should be taking vitamin D. And the reason I say this is it has been shown to decrease the symptoms of the flu, and we are all low in vitamin D. here in Cody. If you're not taking vitamin D, you don't have to get checked. You're low. and so I do, that's the only thing I can recommend to patients at this point, because darker skin people have lower vitamin D levels. Because their skin blocks a lot of the sunlight to transform to vitamin D. So we still don't understand. We're getting there. We're getting better every week.
Yeah.
Today is not a vitamin D day.
No, it's not. Well, so how much of that stuff do you take, you know?
I think the recommended daily allotment is something like, it's only like 10 or 20. I use international units, so it's a little different. I recommend between 2 and 5,000 international units daily. If you're not getting out in the much, if you're not getting out in the sun very much, you should be taking 5,000 international units daily. This is a med that if you take too much of, it's super rare, but it can become toxic. So don't be taking mega doses of this. It's an oil soluble vitamin, and you can't just take a ton of it, because it starts having detrimental effects past probably 10,000 international units a day. If you start going above that, it can have some toxic effects at that point, because you get an overload of vitamin D. And some people say, well, during the summer, I'm out in the sun all day long. A local fisherman and I, we decided to do an experiment, because he's out in the sun constantly. And we measured his vitamin D at the beginning of the summer and the end of the summer. And it was not appreciably different. It was higher, but it still wasn't in a normal range. And that's because the angle of our sun, even if you're in the sun a lot, it just does not, it's not enough to produce vitamin D.
The biggies have always seemed to be cardiovascular disease, kidney disease, diabetes, respiratory problems, and age, right? Those always seem to be, from when this first broke out, those are the danger categories. So the people that weren't in those categories felt like, I don't have to worry about that too much. But I heard a program the other day where they were saying that the single biggest factor in deaths throughout the United States has been obesity. That they were saying that 6 out of 10 people that have died were obese, and that, of course, the percentage of the American population that is obese was fairly phenomenal. So,
one good thing, if people would quit drinking sodas and eating chips as a result of this, we would cut our obesity rate. So if that is one positive effect of the coronavirus, that would be good. But I think that's wistful thinking. All of those, you know, you mentioned cardiovascular, diabetes, and those. I mean, obesity is a risk factor for diabetes, and those are all can compromise your ability to fight any illness. So we saw that with influenza when it was rampant earlier in the year, that those individuals with underlying medical conditions had a higher risk of morbidity and mortality.
So again, we've talked on numerous occasions about preventative measures. If there's any supplements you can take, if there's anything that you can do in preparation for, if you get this, to limit the effect that it's going to have on you. It sounds to me like vitamin D and exercise and change in diets are probably something you can do immediately that might improve your chances.
So the big thing about those is they're not going to hurt you. If you start taking hydroxychloroquine to prevent this, it can hurt you. It can not only hurt you, it can kill you. But these are things that are going to be beneficial, even if in the end we find out, oh, it has nothing to do with preventing how bad this disease gets, or if you get this disease. There's going to be beneficial effects of, if you live in Kodiak, taking vitamin D, getting your heart rate up on a daily basis, taking a few pounds off. These are all things that are going to be healthy in the end. But I do think, rather than supplements, if you can take, you know, everyone wants to take a multivitamin. There's never been a clear benefit of any multivitamin in health. Zero, except for pregnant women. And so I have a hard time recommending vitamins, because I think that we should be getting our food, our nutrition through food, not through pills.
Got a question here. It's encouraging to note that most Kodiak old timers go masked and keep their distances, but many of the newbies and philosophical naysayers don't seem to be doing that. What's the infection rate by age group from 20 to 50 and 60 to 80? Do we know that?
It sounds like you're saying everybody's between 20 and 50. So I guess payback comes, I guess, for not wearing the mask and stuff. I don't know.
Yeah, and it's seems like countries that enforce masks and distancing are seeming to have the lowest rates of infection. So why don't we do it here?
We're a rebellious crew here in America. We don't like higher-ups telling us what to do. We're not British anymore for a reason, because we're a bunch of rebels. And I honestly, I joke about it, but there's truth to this. Yeah, there is a sense of we are a free people and we're going to make our own decisions. And we kind of rebel against people telling us what to do. And I cannot tell you how many people I'll pull out 10 studies showing a fact, but the rebellious side, they'll find one obscure study that is horribly done that supports their point of view just to be a rebel. And it's just like, okay, well, you get to make the decision in the end. I'm just being a guide for you.
So there, everything that we get out of the ESC is a suggestion.
Well, you know, even the state mandates or the state advisories, there's really not an enforcement agency that can make people do those things. You know, it's just not how our society works. So
I've had numerous people coming back to Kodiak who were old timers who are coming back to Kodiak for the summer, and they're asking me, so am I going to be stopped in Anchorage and not allowed to continue to Kodiak? We discussed that the requirements were you're supposed to have a PCR testing within 3 days of flying, and it's just impossible to get in a lot of places, and it's virtually impossible to get back in 3 days. And so they were wondering, am I going to be stopped in Anchorage? And I said, I've been telling people, it seems to be on the honor system at this point, that these are what we want you to do, but nobody's enforcing it. It's the honor system at this point.
So what is the suggestion for people now traveling? What's best practices for somebody coming from another place in the state or from another place from the lower 48? I mean, how do we as a community, what would you require of them before allowing them into your bubble?
So I'm on the board of the Kodiak Baptist Mission. They bring people in on a regular basis. We looked at the requirements that you get a test within 3 days. They asked me what would be best. And 2 weeks is pretty tough to have people hunker down for 2 weeks. And my suggestion was to say that they quarantine for 7 days and then they get tested. And my thought behind that is if they were infected 7 days before, the viral load will get sufficiently high enough that it should be detectable at that point. So that if they are truly a carrier, it will pop positive. If they get tested the second they get here, as Dr. Smith has said numerous times, I don't know what that means. I'm not sure what that means. But after 7 days of quarantine, it makes sense to me that you quarantine for 7 days, cuts the required 2 weeks in half, then get tested. And I feel pretty good about hanging out with a person like that. Current requirements, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, are a test within 3 days of leaving. Sometimes I've heard that, or right as soon as you get here, or quarantine for 14 days. There are no guarantees with any of these things. You can quarantine for 14 days and still be shedding virus. We've discussed this, that people have shed virus for 37 days afterwards, or even longer. So there's no guarantee for any of this. Are we going to catch the vast majority with these methods? Yeah, we are. And if you quarantine for 7 days and then get tested, we're going to catch the vast majority of people who are carrying this virus.
And I think just to add to that, the state recommendation is if you have that PCR test before you fly in, then you're given a voucher to have a second test after 7 days. It's on the honor system to do that. You're still asked, you know, if you come with a negative PCR test into the state, you're asked to basically do a 1 week quarantine and then have a second test before you're, in theory, free to go. The problem with that is it's on the honor system. People get here, they go, hey, I'm negative. I got this paper, but it's, you know, it's an honor system. And so some individuals will always go elsewhere and not affect that second test.
So we've got people from, you know, different parts of the state, and they can go to the airport. They don't need to go to the airport. They don't need to have any kind of testing whatsoever to come to Kodiak, and then there's no requirement that they get tested once they get here. If they come from outside, but, you know, with cases popping up around the state, just because that isn't a requirement, don't we want to make it a requirement if you are going to be the person visiting with them?
I mean, it's still, I just think you still, if you're doing the things you're supposed to doing and keeping your distance and things, you're going to be safe. Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, Homer's really heavy right now, and Anchorage is too, and there's some other spots, so I would be concerned, but I don't know that we can require anybody to
do that. No, we can personally require it. You can personally require it.
And, you know, I have to give a lot of credit in Kodiak right now, and mostly due to Canna's efforts, we have testing pretty available. But even they're going to have limits. I mean, you know, I mean, they're there till whenever trying to process a gazillion tests. I mean, you know, there is some capacity, you know, where we can't test 200 people that get off every plane, you know, to check.
But the Alaska Airlines folks yesterday said they're working with Canna now to have a testing facility at the airport.
Yeah, I mean, they're going to give it a try, but I will have to commend the people in the lab at KCHC and Canna. I can't describe how many hours and paperwork is done on a daily basis to test 70 people. If it were as easy as just sliding it in the machine and you're on your way, it's not. There's tons of paperwork with each test and making sure things are all properly labeled so we don't get mixed up on things. It's a tedious, tough process, and people who are doing it do not enjoy it. And so I personally say thank you to those people in the lab, because it's not a glorifying process to do all this stuff. But yes, Canada is talking about opening a facility at the airport so people can be tested as they come in and also before they go to villages.
I think that's a big
effort. Yeah. I think that's a great idea.
Before they go to the villages.
And so it's one more way of protecting our villages who don't have access to the same level of care as we do here in town.
So now there is testing available at the airport in Anchorage. Yes. So if people choose to do that, then they have a negative test and they're allowed to travel. You know, that negative test still gives people the idea that everything is fine. So then we still locally need to put on the restriction that, you know, it's fine, but you're fine and you're fine isolated for 7 days before we involve you in our closer circles, right?
So that negative test means, I mean, now they're kind of changing the terminology and saying virus undetectable.
Yeah.
Because you could still have the virus in it. So a negative doesn't mean that you have a clean bill of health. So I think, you know, that 7 days, you know, and they even ask in the advisory, in the travel mandate that came out, that people, they can go with that test that's negative, but to really limit their contact with others. You know, I mean, if you want to come and you want to drive up, you know, drive around the state and really not see people and enjoy Alaska, that is super, you know. It's just going into a crowded place or being with a lot of people that puts people at more risk.
Okay. I don't want to beat a dead horse here, but if someone is, we've got, you just alluded to 200 numbers. I'm not sure how many people are coming in on planes these days.
But they're getting like between 80 and 100 every day.
And you're saying our testing capacity is at 60 or 70?
No, that's the average.
Yeah.
But 80 is really taxing.
80 would be tough. I mean, if we're going to add 80 daily.
above.
That would be that. I got to tell you, at 70, our crew is working hard. And so if we went up to 80, we'd have to get more personnel on it. We'd have to dedicate more space, more time and space to it.
Okay. So if people were being meticulous about this and wanted to come into the community and they had a test already done and they wanted a follow-up test, it's going to put an incredible burden on the system to probably check all those people.
We'll be working with it, though. The health community in Kodiak is going to step up. We are fortunate because I have talked to people in the lower 48 who looked to get tested before they came. And the finding it was very difficult. And on top of that, it was a $500 test. Here in Kodiak, they'll charge your insurance, but no charges go to the patient themselves. Dr. Kohler runs antibody test at his office, and he does it just for the cost of a nurse visit. And so the health care community has been very generous with these tests. Mm-hmm. And you can pretty much get it on demand at this point. You still have to set up an account with KCHC or CANA so that it can be properly reported if you go to get tested at the tent. But it's fairly easy to get a test now.
And I will say, too, that right now there is the availability across the country. LabCorp has its Pixel system that you can. Dr. Anders from ANTHC in Anchorage sent in his thing on a Tuesday. He got his kit on Wednesday, and he had results in 51 hours, and it's about $100. I mean, there are a lot of more of these kind of testing that you can get outside of having to tax the medical community. They're really pushing that for a lot of the assisted living homes and places that just need to test everybody. If they can do them through these processes and Medicaid and Medicare will pay for it, then taking some of that off of the healthcare system that's, you know, potentially being strained.
So one thing that's we talked about air travel, and, you know, like Alaska Airlines requires your mask while you're on the airplane. But the breakdown is at our airport and probably every other airport is look at the number of people who they have to wear their mask on the plane, or Alaska Airlines says you're not flying. Whether they put people in a no-fly list if they don't comply with that, that's Alaska Airlines' decision. But watch people in a crowded area. As soon as they get off, they hate the mask. Even hates his mask. He's do anything to not wear it, but he knows he has to. And you watch, there are videos out there of people in airports, and as soon as they walk off that airplane, that mask comes off, you know. And maybe that's okay from the ramp or from the steps on the Alaska flight. Walking in the terminal, you could probably take it off for a second and go, oh, I can breathe. But you should put it back on, because all of a sudden you got a whole group of people there and it's not required in the terminals, and, you know, social physical distancing breaks down right there. And that's, we can't emphasize enough that you have to think about everybody else around you.
So let's just give you, you know, your folks are all in the medical field. How do you safely travel? If you have to go someplace, how do you do it?
I would wear my mask. I would wash my hands. I would respect, keep away from people. As even said, the regular mask, it isn't going to protect you from everything, but it's going to protect you from a lot of big goobers that people cough out and sneeze out. So that's going to, it's still going to provide you a lot of protection.
Goobers. Goober,
that's a new medical term.
let's talk about dexamethasone.
So early on, when people were watching this disease process and thinking that this was an overreaction by the immune system, I think all of us in the medical profession and diseases like this, we start looking at a steroid. To calm things down. When somebody comes in with community-acquired pneumonia and they have a huge reaction to this, in addition to antibiotics, we'll think about adding a steroid on. And I think immediately all of us thought, well, let's throw a steroid at this. Early on, that they found that there was either neutral or negative outcomes to using a steroid. And now we just have a study coming out that, you know, in the worst cases, when people are already on a ventilator and people are doing poorly, using a steroid can be life-saving. We've heard the number needed to treat is about 8. So you got to treat 8 people, and one of those people will have a positive result. And it's a significant positive result by using a steroid called dexamethasone. This is a long-acting steroid. It's usually good for about 4 or 5 days. We use it for things like asthma and croup and what else?
Mountain sickness.
Yeah. So it's a commonly used med. The hospital has it. I'm sure Canada has it. I wouldn't be surprised if the pharmacy has it. But here's the caveat before you run out and ask your physician to get this drug so that you don't get sick. This is for very ill people. And the reason why steroids probably showed no benefit in these early studies is because we're giving it to everybody who came in with this illness. Well, most of the symptoms of the illness early in the disease are caused by the virus itself, and we need an immune reaction to beat that virus down. What steroids do is they dampen the immune response. So if you give the steroid early in the disease, the virus is going to get out of control and overwhelm the body. As we get further along in the disease process, people who get very, very ill, we do find it's our own immune system that has a severe overreaction to this disease. And much of the late disease process, when people are going on ventilators and people are having a lot of fluids in their lungs, is our own immune system that's causing that. And so once we get to that point where people are extremely ill and requiring a ventilator to stay alive, then the dexamethasone, the steroid, is helpful. I would be suspicious that probably about any steroid would be effective at that point. Dexamethasone happens to be the drug that was studied. And so it is a promising new treatment for people who are very ill. It is totally inappropriate to take a steroid for people early in this disease process because it probably will worsen the disease process.
So this is the same kind of model we saw with hydroxy when it first was being touted, where people were making a rush to buy this and use it as a preventative, right? There's no reason why you should go on the internet and look for this dexamethasone and use it yourself.
If you are well enough to look on the internet for this medication, you don't need it.
You don't need it.
And there's a lot of side effects with that medication, too, even when you do steroids.
Yep.
You're careful.
Yeah, I mean, it's steroids are a great drug. People with arthritis and many other things or COPD will give them a steroid burst. To be honest, they feel great. And I wish I could keep these patients on steroids forever because they feel good when they're on it. Unfortunately, it has a lot of side effects. It causes thinning bones, thinning skin. It dampens down to the immune system to the point where it's no longer functional. It can tear holes in your gut. And so there's a lot of side effects with these medications. They work great when used appropriately. But used inappropriately, in this case especially, it will make the disease process worse.
So it's been highly praised and touted for those special type cases. Is there any new thing on the medical front? Is there any new kinds of treatment that we're optimistic about? Is there more optimism about vaccines these days?
I don't know that there's new optimism, but continued optimism that eventually we can maybe get ahead of the virus, develop a vaccine, but that's going to take time. I've said it before, you can't push science. It takes time to develop a vaccine. I think when Curtis was here, you know, when we give people vaccines, we're giving healthy individuals a medication that could have a lot of side effects. So you want that to be very well tested. You know, if we give a vaccine to 100 people and it protects 75, but the other 25 get a severe reaction to it, have we succeeded? And so I think right now we don't know enough to say anything in particular is going to be the cure-all, except what we're doing now. As Elsa said and even said, you gotta wear your mask, wash your hands, protect yourself and other people with physical distancing. I like the term on a Terry Gross interview this morning on Fresh Air that they talked to an ID doc in
Minnesota. Yeah.
But he, you know, going to the term physical distancing doesn't mean social distancing. You still need to have interaction with people. We're social individuals, and that's so you still want to have that interaction. Elsa mentioned that rather than calling a test negative, virus load not detected, I think changes your mindset to go, this is out there. We can't ignore it.
A follow-up on something that we were talking about earlier with testing is that Dr. Collar's office does the PCR testing, and it's free there, so that's another.
Just to be careful, I'm not sure the PCR testing is free. I don't want to speak to him on the PCR testing because that's a send-out that costs him a fair amount of money.
Okay. But it's an additional number of tests that are available in the community.
That's true. And Dr. Kohler's office and Dr. Creelman's office has the ability to even work with the tent people and do that kind of thing, any provider in the community. The only difference is some of these may, you know, some a lot of this, the testing has been made to no cost to the client, but there still may be a visit and at times, depending on where somebody is.
Dr. Kohler is still the only one that's doing the antibody testing in town, though.
So we do send out also at Canna, and so we have been expanding our antibody send out. When these tests first came out, the study seemed, so the way they were discussing whether they were accurate or not is they took people who were known positive and then 14 days later tested them to see if they had an antibody to the disease, and the tests were coming back near 100%. Accurate. Now you start throwing all comers in there, and we're finding, well, this antibody, we might be having antibody positive to people who had similar diseases, but not necessarily coronavirus. So we get some false positives in there. And so those of you who've looked into coronavirus know that, well, there's tons of coronavirus out there. It's kind of the look of the virus more than anything that we name it coronavirus, but they are very closely related to many other viruses. And so there may be antibodies that are similar between the common cold and COVID-19.
So this is kind of the flip side. We've talked about the testing and the false negatives with the rapid ID tests. So the antibody test, I was just listening to a broadcast that it's the flip side of that, that there are false positives on the antibody test because that antibody test, these were rapidly developed with not a lot of long-term studies to say these are selective for this particular COVID-19 virus. You know, the other coronaviruses, maybe they look the same and it cross-reacts. So now you get an antibody test that says it's positive. Does that really, is it positive for COVID-19 and does it protect you? So now we're going to see people who go, I had the antibody test, I'm protected, and you might not be. It's a false positive, which is also, you know, if you're falsely positive, it gives you a false sense of security. So I think the science is still out there, and the tests, like even sending off, they're going to epidemiology type studies to really see how accurate these tests are. And again, we don't know.
So you're kind of saying that they're most effective for people who have already gone through the symptoms and already had the disease and had tested positive at one time for the traditional test, and then afterwards.
Yes.
Okay. I have one final question from a listener. If we are more like Hawaii, why aren't we doing more like Hawaii?
Yeah, they're very strict there to the point where they're checking people's Facebook pages, and if they see you out on the beach breaking their requirements, they will arrest you. Mm-hmm. Alaska has decided not to make quite as intensive an enforcement of the recommendations. We are not as crowded as Hawaii. We're not as congested as Hawaii. But that's a decision their government has made, that they're going to strictly enforce what's the way people come and go.
Has it been successful in them being able to avoid these spikes that we're seeing in Alaska?
You know, I'm not sure about Hawaii's numbers. I'm not sure.
Well, I think that'll do it for today. What do you think? Unless there's
sounds good.
We're not getting any more questions coming in. I think we've answered everything that we could answer for this week. So we forge ahead.
Yeah, I just keep asking people, don't get too complacent with this. Continue to do the right thing. And it's hard to keep this level of vigilance for so long. But we are getting the spike right now. And so I really encourage for the next couple of weeks, make a renewed effort to kind of protect yourself and others. And we'll kind of see how we're at. Even in 1 week, we'll get a good picture. We have two community outbreaks, so it's a tough one.
Yeah. Well, best of luck to all of you. Thanks for coming in again and sharing your knowledge with the community. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Have a good week.
Thank you.